Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Reality takes a bite out of the Bronx.
The FBI did exactly what they're trained to do and have prevented what could be a terrible event in our city.
Mayor Michael Bloomberg talking about the arrest of four suspects with fake bombs and unusable weapons. They struck fear into two New York communities. A terror group chooses targets and tries to strike. Who helped them and why? When investigations and participation collide, a sleeper cell awakes. Get up already. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Thursday, May 21st, full coverage of a terror plot event that unfolded last night. I'm John Hockenberry, joined by Catherine Lamford. Good morning, Catherine.
Hey, good morning, John. We're also this hour going to look at elections in Iran, the arraignment in New York today of a piracy suspect, and Michael Vick's release from prison. Also, the gender gap and happiness. All this and more, but first, these headlines.
And in the headlines, law enforcement has broken up a plot to attack Jewish targets in New York and shoot down planes from a nearby military base. Four men are under arrest and due in court today. Investigators say they infiltrated the group early on. They say the men never got the weapons they needed to pull off the strikes, but did plant fake bombs. We'll bring you more on this in a live conversation coming up in just a moment. What to do with high-profile terror suspects? That's the focus of President Obama's highly anticipated speech later this morning. A little more highly anticipated with the revelations overnight. He'll explain plans for closing the Guantanamo Bay prison camp. A bipartisan group of senators is blocking his path, though, at this point.
Now, the administration is already rolling out new plans for one Gitmo detainee. The man accused in the 1998 bombings of American embassies in Africa will stand trial in New York. He'll be the first Gitmo prisoner brought to the U.S., the first to stand trial in a civilian criminal court. And as we've mentioned, the president isn't the only one talking terror today. Former Vice President Dick Cheney will speak at a think tank just minutes after President Obama. He's harshly criticized the current administration's stance on terror and the plans to close Guantanamo.
News this morning of an apparent attack on Serbia's presidency. This just as Vice President Biden is in the region on a diplomatic mission. Reports say a man with explosives is in the Serbian president's headquarters. It's not clear whether the president is inside. Police have the area surrounded. The vice president was in Serbia yesterday. And again, that's the Serbian president involved in some sort of an attack.
Now, John, we're going to have fresh economic news out in about an hour. A new report will tell us the number of new weekly jobless claims. Forecasters expect unemployment filings to rise a bit from the previous week.
Well, they've been wrong a lot on the weekly jobless
yeah,
claims.
Yeah, that's true. They go up and down.
It's a very erratic figure. The S&P and the Dow both slipped about 0.5% yesterday. The Dow kicks off at 84.22. Later on in the program, we're talking about how happiness or progress towards equality and in the economy for women has not translated into more happiness. What do you think?
A few weeks before I turned 50 years old, my significant other decided he didn't want to be together. Now, almost 5 years later, I am most happy in my job, my work. The trade-off was my significant other for the job of my dreams.
Is there a job of your dreams in your life making you more happy or less happy? Some statistics suggest that progress on the job front doesn't mean more happiness for women. 877-8-MY-TAKE. What do you think? How does that work in your life? MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Catherine Lamfer. At 9 p.m. last night, police swept in and arrested four men allegedly involved in a plot to bomb two synagogues in New York City. Officials said the men had actually planted bombs, or what they thought were bombs, and were looking for the capability to shoot down military planes in Newburgh, New York. This morning, Mayor Bloomberg, after a night of anxiety for people in Newburgh and the Bronx, was all about reassurance.
To me, I come out of this feeling more confident than ever before. When there is something, the police department discovers it and stops it.
As we said, four men are in custody. They will be arraigned in White Plains, New York, later on this morning. But what was the detail of the plots? Well, they're beginning to leak out. Here's a spokesman for the FBI.
They have bags that were set up, they believe to be bombs, carrying about 30 pounds of explosives, what they believe to be explosives. Here we had vehicles staged by us, by the Joint Terrorism Task Force. They would place a satchel or a bag in a vehicle in front of the temple down the block, and then two more bags into a vehicle parked in front of the synagogue here.
Talking about the fake explosives, Joseph Demarest, assistant director in charge of the FBI's New York division, talking about the fake explosives that were picked up as part of the arrest when police swooped in and brought four men into custody. As I mentioned, they will be arraigned at 1 p.m. this afternoon in White Plains, New York. Joining us now, Bob Henley, WNYC reporter, who's been following this story since the beginning. Bob, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
And Bruce Hoffman, terrorism expert with the RAND Corporation, longtime expert on both the prosecutorial tactics, the investigative tactics, and some of the terms that came up in the complaint that were filed here. Jaish-e-Mohammed, we'll talk about that with Bruce in a moment. Bruce, thanks for joining us.
That's fine, but I'm at Georgetown University now.
You're at Georgetown? Okay. Well, I got at least one thing wrong there. Bruce, thanks for correcting me on that. Bob Henley, first of all, where do we stand? What's likely to come up at the arraignment at 1 later today?
Well, certainly details about their age, and we'll begin to see some kind of the government will put out more of their hand. One of the things that's already emerging is this goes back to June 2008, an experienced confidential informant, six-year history with the FBI, was evidently trolling around a mosque in Newburgh, New York, Orange County, that's 60 miles of New York City, a kind of exurban place, but you can still find cows up there. It's in close proximity to Stewart Air Force Base, which was a major transit point for the U.S. military to get supplies to Afghanistan and Iraq. And this confidential informant basically came forward, went to the FBI, and then over a year now, pretty much gave these four individuals, James Cromite, David Williams, Unta Williams, and Laguerre-Pien, the sense that he had access to weaponry and to the kind of things they'd need to pull off this simultaneous plot, pretty bold, actually, to try to bomb two synagogues in Riverdale and also take out U.S. military aircraft at Newburgh.
All right, Bruce, three of the men are apparently American citizens here. Before we talk about the investigative techniques and how the FBI followed this organization, is this a disturbing example of potentially homegrown terrorism here, Bruce?
I think it's a disturbing example of radicalization in that you have individuals that were clearly looking to commit some act of terrorism. And as Bob was saying, we're trawling around, you know, this mosque, or at least soliciting information on how to obtain the weapons. Certainly, also, I think the reconnaissance involved in this shows that they were quite serious, because these two synagogues in the Riverdale section of the Bronx, one's on 237th Street, one's on 246th Street, I mean, you would only know that by, in other words, actively surveilling what likely targets would be. So I think we have to take this quite seriously.
Unless the confidential informant was the one who came up with the targets, and we don't know that. Bruce first, and then Bob. Bruce?
Oh, my understanding is that it was not who had come up with the targets. My only point is that this had gotten to the point of actually
right. The
terrorists believed they were going to execute a plot and had selected targets, so it meant they'd done their homework.
Bob, the complaint describes the role of the confidential informant here. How much precedent is there for this kind of use of a confidential informant?
Very strong in the United States. I mean, the government has had success here making these cases. What ends up happening, there are usually a couple of days in a full-blown jury trial where the confidential informant's credibility is on the line. So the degree to which the individual has a criminal past, or it becomes, if it looks like he is egged on the people that were participating, then the government takes a hit. In England, it looks like there's a little bit of terror fatigue there. They haven't been as successful of late making these cases. The central question here, though, is that it looks like the government let this plot go farther than usual in the sense that these individuals last night, according to the government, really thought they were doing something and took major overt actions. The other thing that hasn't really been discussed is the government evidently let them buy a 9mm handgun in Brooklyn back in April. And so that certainly added a level of edginess here. And I might add that ESU was in full body armor yesterday when they took these guys out. So
what's ESU? What's ESU?
Emergency Service Unit, which is the top NYPD forces that deal with this kind of thing. I guess the government has this constant balancing act between if they do it too soon, then they look like nothing was really going to happen. If they let it go too far, there's a chance that someone could get hurt. And that's a tough balancing act.
Bruce, all right, I'm a resident of Riverdale this morning, all right? Just to, let's pretend, okay? Mayor Bloomberg is saying there was no threat here, absolutely no threat here, absolutely no threat here. The rabbi in my community is saying there was a threat. We have to be very, very concerned this morning. Which is it? Am I more nervous this morning or less nervous this morning, depending on how this played out?
Well, there certainly was the threat of that, there's no doubt, because there was a plot to attack the two synagogues. I think the question is, as Bob just described, is how far the authorities let the plot unfold, in other words, to get them caught red-handed, as it were, to have a case that would be rock solid in court, at least that they were in the process of committing the crime. But there, at least my understanding, is that New York City police and FBI and Joint Terrorism Task Force personnel were there to control the incident. So whatever possibility there might have been of something going awry seems to have been very closely anticipated and very tightly controlled.
Hey, Bruce, I want to talk about, you know, remember the Lackawanna Six? We had a case where there was all this attention. Everyone said, oh, we're safer now. We foiled this. And then it petered out a bit when it actually hit the legal system.
Well, again, and this is why I think this plot was allowed to proceed as far as it did, and why the perpetrators were, you know, at least under the assumption that they were in the process of committing an actual terrorist attack, and it's for that reason to secure convictions. But I think the problem is, too, it's not just the Lackawanna Six. We've had the Fort Dix plot last year where you had a group of individuals that once again sought out someone with access to weaponry, someone with access to training, but had never gotten as far as actually going through the motions of believing that they were perpetrating a terrorist act. And, of course, then there's a different comfort level once charges are brought against them in court, whether a conviction can be secured.
Although, Bob, it sounds like what Bruce is saying, that the pattern is developing here where prosecutors and investigators basically have to encourage these kind of keystone cop terrorist types who have strong intent but little availability to impress a judge. And in the course of that, they end up terrifying communities.
It dials back to our basic premise of the war on terrorism was that we're fighting them over there so they don't come here. In point of fact, we may be actually proliferating these homegrown terrorism things because of the global nature of information. Clearly in the complaint, these individuals that are being charged here, we're seeing the pictures of the civilian deaths that the U.S. military has conceded has happened as collateral damage in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they have made a moral equivalency, right or wrong, between the civilian deaths there at the hands of the U.S. military and what they think needs to happen here. And so that social alienation is troubling. The fact that people, that this war on terror was predicated on, that we could keep that over there, the containment's not working if we're talking about alienation being the thing we're concerned about.
Bruce Hoffman, I'll give you the last word here. Are these tactics, as you're seeing them in the complaint, a sign that the FBI is on top of things or that they're needing convictions to develop a track record?
No, my view would be that they're on top of things. I mean, society can't demand of our authorities that they preempt and prevent terrorist attacks if we're not going to give them the tools and the means to do so.
And the tools and means in this particular case involve helping this plot unfold to the point where a judge sees that these individuals plant the bombs?
No, I would interpret it differently. I would say it's the use of an informant to detect a terrorist plot and to derail it, but then to ensure that the evidence is sufficient in a very controlled circumstance, which, at least according to reports, this seems to have been, in order to secure a conviction. And not just the conviction of those individuals, but to send a powerful message to other would-be radicals in the United States that we're prepared and that we're able to derail their attacks and identify them.
Bruce Hoffman, terrorism expert at Georgetown University. Bob Henley, WNYC reporter. One other detail I want to give you. All these men apparently had links to Afghanistan, and the term Jaish-e-Mohammed, a Pakistani terrorist group, was named in the complaint, although so far no links to Pakistan. All the details later on this morning. Bob and Bruce, thanks so much.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. I just want to clarify, you know, there was a link of one of the suspects in the alleged terror plot to Afghanistan, a family link, not a security link. Again, it's all being investigated, and we'll have details all morning. I'm here with Catherine Lamford. Good morning, Catherine.
Hey, good morning, John. Now, I'm going to take you back to April. We're in the waters off the Horn of Africa, and here is U.S. Admiral William Gortney describing the rescue of Captain Richard Phillips from the American-flagged ship the Maersk Alabama, which, as you recall, had been attacked by pirates.
Snipers positioned on a fantail of the Bain Bridge observed one of the pirates in the pilot house and two pirates with their head and shoulders exposed, and one of the pirates had the AK-47 leveled at the captain's back.
Now, the only one of the pirates to survive that rescue, Abdul Wali Musay, faces a 10-count indictment, and he'll be arraigned later today. To talk about the first piracy prosecution in the U.S. in more than a century, we have Ron Kuby with us. He's a criminal defense attorney, Air America radio host, and he's been consulting on the case on behalf of the defendant's parents. Thanks for being here this morning.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, what exactly is your consulting role?
Basically, I've been in touch with the Somali community out of Minneapolis, the Somali Advocacy and Justice Center. They contacted me on behalf of the family as soon as Mr. Musay was arrested, and I've been giving them my perspective on the case, possible defenses, and we also have a legal team that's willing to work should Mr. Musay make that decision.
And why do his parents need legal consulting?
Well, they're trying to understand what's going on in the American legal system. And even people who have worked in the American legal system for decades frequently have a hard time figuring out what's going on.
Now, you were actually approached to defend Musay, so
yes.
Why'd you say no?
I didn't say no.
Okay. Tell me what you said.
I'm not going to tell you what I said. I'm not in a position to do that, but I can say that I've been engaged in talks with Mr. Musay's family about the possibility of representing him in the future. The case
so
is in a very early
no, stage. So he said no, and you wanted to do it?
I haven't met him yet.
Okay.
When he was brought in, remember the way this process goes. He's brought in by the federal authorities, whisked into court, has federal lawyers appointed for him in consultation with the federal judge, and then you have the federal prosecutors, and he goes to a federal jail. He's sort of been in a little isolated bubble after his little excursion on the Indian Ocean.
Now, what exactly, how would you explain the elements of the charge of piracy under the law?
The most important element in the law of piracy, as it's defined by the nations of the world, and that is also the American definition, is that piracy has to be undertaken for personal gain. That is, the actions that are being undertaken, the motivation has to be personal gain. And the reason the law of nations exists that way is that historically, nations have used privateers, if you will, or even in our American Constitution, we have letters of marque and reprisal, where historically nations and nation states in little groups would use so-called pirates to attack the merchant seamen of their enemies or potential enemies, and those people didn't want to be thought of as pirates.
All right.
The way you became a pirate is if you just keep it for yourself.
Why do I feel like we're walking toward a defense here of, listen, he wasn't doing this for personal gain. He was doing this on behalf of a war-torn country where people are mired in poverty.
Well, because it's probably true. That's one important reason. And the other reason is the prosecution, if they're actually going to proceed with this ridiculous piracy charge.
What makes it so ridiculous?
The prosecution has the burden of proving that he was acting solely for personal gain, rather than to put an end to overfishing in Somali waters, rather than attempting to stop the flow of arms.
If it was about the overfishing, wouldn't there have been something said about that during the whole drama that we watched unfold on the high seas?
What do we know that has been said and what hasn't been said? And even if he was acting on behalf of a Somali sort of social welfare group trying to engage in a little bit of wealth redistribution from these giant merchant
ships.
That's
really pretty language for someone having an AK-47 at someone's back.
Well, that guy is dead. Remember, that guy is dead. That was three shots, three dead people, which dramatically escalates, by the way, the level of violence. And now you have the United States, because the pirates, I know we hate them because they've been demonized,
but
they didn't actually kill anybody.
Yeah, but Ron, you know, the thing that, and amplifying what Catherine is saying, I mean, doesn't it make a difference if most of the world learns that they're freedom fighters from you and maybe not from them? Does that make a difference? If like lawyers in the defense team are the ones that are telling us of their cause, that makes a difference versus them actually giving that information out themselves?
Well, they have given. I mean, the people that you want to call the pirates, mm-hmm. generally, have made this point repeatedly. And in fact, I think most people recognize the origin of Somali piracy began when European ships were dumping toxic nuclear waste off Somali waters because there was no functioning Somali government, and ships regularly entered into Somali waters. As recently as a couple weeks ago, Egyptian trawlers went into Somali waters and were engaged in overfishing. So that very much remains an issue. But in the absence of a functioning central government, what you end up having in Somalia are groups, warlord groups, social service groups, Islamic groups, a variety of different groups, who indeed prey on one large group of otherwise predatory capitalists. I mean, I know the Maersk Alabama is said to have been containing relief supplies, but it also contained other things.
And we're going to have to contain this conversation right here. Thank you for coming on with me, Ron Kuby, a criminal defense attorney, also host of Doing Time with Ron Kuby. That is a political talk show on Air America Media. And now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's just come from the newsroom with the latest headlines.
Thanks, Catherine. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Four terror suspects head to court today after a joint police and FBI investigation busted their plot to blow up targets in New York and shoot down military planes. New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg praised the FBI's work this morning.
The FBI did exactly what they're trained to do, and have prevented what could be a terrible event in our city.
The police infiltrated the group and had an informant give the suspects fake bombs. Officials say the men wanted to commit acts of jihad. On Capitol Hill, GMAC is set to get another bailout from the Treasury. GMAC is the former financial arm of General Motors. Numerous reports say that GMAC is getting another $7.5 billion from the Treasury, which would bring the company's federal tab to more than $12 billion. The deal is expected to close today. There's news this morning overseas of an apparent attack on Serbia's president, and this comes as Vice President Biden is in the region on a diplomatic mission. Reports say that a man with explosives is in the Serbian president's headquarters. Now, it's not clear whether the president is inside. Police have the area surrounded, and the vice president was in Serbia just yesterday. And finally, in sports, the Super Bowl champs head to the White House this morning to meet the president. But Pittsburgh Steelers linebacker James Harris won't be joining the team. He says the trip is, and I'm going to quote him here, no big deal.
Sounds like a bit of a crank, huh?
That's lucky news for now.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Catherine Lamfer. And later on in the program, we're going to be talking about how parity in the job market and improving economic fortunes for women in the American workforce hasn't brought with it happiness. Progress, but no happiness? Is there a trade-off here?
This is going to be my dream job in social work, and I was going to save not the world, maybe, but one person at a time. And I found that the hours are longer than I thought they would be, and the trade-off has been my own family, my children.
How has that trade-off worked in your life? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now, young folks, sit down in front of your radio and hear a tale. Once upon a time, Michael Vick was the most talented man in the National Football League.
Welcome to the Michael Vick Experience.
Okay. Enjoy the ride.
Enjoy the ride. Nike did for a while they endorsed Michael Vick to the tune of a few million, but then Michael Vick got into some serious trouble. Dogfighting offenses. He was locked up for 19 months. He was released from Leavenworth, Kansas prison yesterday, and he'll spend the next 2 months under house arrest in Virginia working in construction for about 10 bucks an hour. Michael Vick's rehabilitation is not simply something that took place in prison. It's something that will be slowly unfolding over the next several months as the world figures out where Michael Vick will go and what the NFL might actually do with him again. Joining us to talk about all this is Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway contributor and sports blogger. Ibrahim, thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
I know you have lots to say on this subject. We also have two fans from the Atlanta Falcons. Of course, Vick was an Atlanta Falcon before he got into trouble, lost his endorsements, and lost the faith of the NFL. Is it retrievable? We'll find out in a moment. Richard Palmer, good morning from Atlanta.
Good morning.
And Larry Jamison, also from Atlanta. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Larry, Michael Vick is headed back maybe to the playing field. We shall see. What do you think about that, Larry?
I figured that he'd probably get a chance. I'm glad to hear from Arthur Blank it won't be with us.
Us meaning the Atlanta Falcons.
That's correct.
Richard Palmer, now, was Michael Vick's difficulties a real heartbreaker for Atlanta Falcons fans who are really looking for Vick to take them all the way to the Super Bowl?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, we're still yet to achieve a back-to-back winning season here in Atlanta. And, yeah, everybody thought he was the one that could take us there. Very talented athlete and, I think, talented quarterback.
Talent on the football field, in life, maybe a little bit dubious. Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Michael Vick totally blew it in both getting involved in this dogfighting ring, the way he handled it. I mean, from the moment it was clear that he was going to get convicted, he became all apologetic. You know, I believe he found the Lord in all of this, of course. What is the trajectory back to the playing field for Michael Vick, Ibrahim?
The question here is, can you forgive a felon with a fantastic arm? And the key thing here is that he's a felon. And it asks a larger question in our society, is that what do we do? How do we accept people back into society once they've done something wrong? Can they avoid double indemnity?
Well, back in society is not a question. Michael Vick can be anywhere he wants to be. The question is, does he get a multi-million dollar contract and become this huge story that the NFL is going to basically be trumpeting as he comes back to the field to all kinds of media attention?
I think if you, if a doctor gets arrested and with a felony, a lawyer, they don't get to come back and take those positions that they previously had before. So I think if you take that example, there's an argument that says that Michael Vick should not be let back into the NFL. However, he's an exceptional athlete. He's the third all-time in rushing for quarterbacks. Someone's going to take him back. It may not be the NFL. It might be the UFL, which is a new league starting up.
Right. So, Richard, the birds in the background there in your backyard seem to be pro-Vick.
It's not a question of if, it's a question of who will pick him up. He'll definitely get a chance. I think everybody will agree with that. And as far as, you know, getting back into society, I like my football players to play football. I'm not looking for them to be role models or operate on me or, you know, defend me in court. So, you know, your doctor, lawyer example, I don't think really holds weight.
All right, Larry Jamison, what's your argument there? I mean, I think Michael Vick is a role model at this point. There's no way around that, good or bad.
Well, whether or not he's a role model, we're very blessed down here in Atlanta to have a good character guy in Matt Ryan. And while Richard may not think that a quarterback needs to be a role model, you just look around at the jerseys that are worn by fans of these teams, and I think they are held to a higher standard.
I mean, there's also a question, and Ibrahim, let me get your question on that, and I want your reaction, Richard. I mean, a lot of kids, football fans, have dogs. It seems to me the chance that a kid, if they like Michael Vick, would act out this kind of felony in their own way, in their own neighborhood, with their own pets, is highly likely here. It's a little bit different than your normal felon, it seems to me, Ibrahim.
I think, I'll push back on Richard. I think I actually think that I'm pro Vick, and I think I think him as a role model and his ability to be a role model for young black males that are actually engaged in this activity
right. Is
even more strengthened by the fact that he's been to jail and he's come back and he's asking for forgiveness and he's saying, listen, I've gone through this process. Roger Goodell said he wants to see true remorse. Well, what does true remorse look like? And so I think that he has an opportunity. I mean, he could become a vegan, and maybe that is what true remorse looks like. But I think he does have an opportunity right now to actually make a bigger impact on stopping dog fighting than he would have before.
All right, Larry and Richard, before we go, is there a certain sector of people in the United States, if Vick comes back, who are just going to be disgusted by the whole thing and give up on the NFL altogether? Larry?
I don't know about giving up on the NFL because the NFL is pretty powerful, but there are certainly people that will feel great disappointment to see him back on a field.
Richard Palmer?
No, people aren't going to give up on the NFL, but yeah, people will be disgusted. But, you need to make a difference between dogfighting and, say, an athlete or anybody else who, for example, beats their wife or kills somebody in a drunk driving accident and basically nothing happened to them. They're playing on Sunday. They're going to work on Monday.
All right, there may be some dog owners that are heartbroken to hear you say that, Richard, but I hear your point. Ibrahim, take us out. Give us the last word here. The NFL's going to take the hit and just go for it?
I think if I'm a GM right now and I know that the business model of the NFL is really strong, I think I would bring Michael Vick back as a running back. No more quarterback. He's the third best rushing quarterback of all time. I'd bring him back as a running back.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen giving advice to GMs in the NFL, sports blogger and takeaway contributor. Thanks so much. And to our listener fans, Richard Palmer and Larry Jamison in Atlanta. Thanks to you both. Headlines now from Femi Okay.
Just coming after 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Just getting this information in. Jobless claims down in last week. The Labour Department says that 631,000 people applied for unemployment benefits last week. That is a drop, but ongoing claims for those benefits rose to 6.7 million. Now, this morning, the president will detail his plan to close the Guantanamo Bay prison. Yesterday, though, the Senate blocked the transfer of detainees to U.S. facilities. And also, the officials of the Obama administration say that a terror suspect detained at Guantanamo will be transferred to the U.S. to stand trial in a civilian court. That's a quick look at headlines. John.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
And I'm John Hockenberry. It's a campaign story. It's also a national security story. The launch of a advanced missile by Iran at the start of the presidential campaign in Iran suggests that the campaign is going to be all about Iran's defiance of the world's concern about its nuclear program. Is that the case? John Line, BBC Tehran correspondent, joining us from Tehran.
Well, maybe that's what President Ahmadinejad would like it to be about, but the other candidates would like it to be about the economy, which they say is in a real mess, and they blame him. And it was interesting. I went to a meeting of one of the candidates' campaigns this morning, one of the opposition candidates, and they were trying to link President Ahmadinejad's foreign policy with the bad state of the economy, blaming him for Iran's international financial isolation and financial sanctions, which they said were damaging the economy.
So, John Line, is it possible that these remarks from Hillary Clinton might be persuasive to Iranian voters? Listen.
Our goal is to persuade the Iranian regime that they will actually be less secure if they proceed with their nuclear weapons program.
Less secure and more economically unstable. Is that persuasive, John Line?
I think that would be the pitch from some of the opposition candidates here as well. But on the other hand, President Ahmadinejad, you know, does a good line in defiance and in trying to stir national pride, and obviously tries to play that nationalist card.
Now, how were the candidates chosen here? Because it seems to me the selection process casts some doubt about the fairness of this election.
They allow pretty much anybody to register. You only have to sign your own name. You haven't got to leave any money or anything. And then a thing called the Guardian Council whittles down the list, and the criteria are in the Constitution say that they must be personalities. Rajul is an Arabic word, who are political and religious personalities, which I think really means eminent personalities. It's not quite clear in the Constitution whether that allows women to stand, but they've all been disqualified. And so have all of the 425-odd candidates who applied, except, to be fair, the main four. And I think most people would have said that the four people who have been left on the ballot paper are the four leading candidates.
Right, so all 42 women registered were ruled out. Now, you mentioned the word Rajul. Is that Arabic or is that Farsi word?
It's an Arabic word. Rather confusingly, they've used
right.
an Arabic word in the Constitution. So people here have to work out precisely what that means. And of course, there's a legalistic argument about whether it is a word meaning exclusively men or meaning person eminent personalities. But anyway, that interpretation is made by the Guardian
right.
Council, which is a group of elderly clerics and jurists, and they have no doubt that it's going to be men.
John Line, finally, before we go, where does the launch of this missile or the announcement of the launch of this missile stand as the details emerged this morning?
I think it was clearly intended for some political purpose. It's not quite clear what, but I think the best guess is that it was an attempt by President Ahmadinejad to grab the limelight on the day that the candidates were announced, to show exactly where he's coming from, which is defiance and national pride, as he was put it. It's nothing particularly groundbreaking in that we've already seen the launch of one of these missiles before, but in the bigger picture, it is quite a... It's one of the longest-range missiles, one of the most advanced missiles Iran has got. And on the other side, on your side of the water, it's interesting that Washington didn't seem to want to take the bait. There was not much condemnation, so there wasn't the kind of big international fuss about it that perhaps President Ahmadinejad was looking for when he personally made the announcement about the launch of this missile test.
Well, a missile launch perhaps breaks the mold of this sort of tit-for-tat taking of the bait between the U.S. and Washington. John Line, BBC Tehran correspondent, covering the beginning of the presidential election in Iran. Thank you, John.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
And I'm John Hockenberry. We got a great email on a subject we're going to be talking about in just a moment. Women have made gains, but maybe they're not so happy as they were in the 1970s. Erica writes on thetakeaway.org, I think that the women's movement still isn't over. Women have broken into the workplace, but men haven't broken into the home. That is why women might be unhappy. When men and women share responsibilities in all aspects of life, then women will feel the advantages we've been fighting for. Then women will be able to be happy. 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Some survey information that suggests women aren't happy even though they've made gains in a moment. First headlines from Femi OK.
Thank you. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Law enforcement has broken up a plot to attack Jewish targets in New York and shoot down planes from a nearby military base. Four men are under arrest and due in court today. Investigators say that they infiltrated the group early on. Authorities arrested them last night after they planted fake bombs provided by a government informant. Here's the NYPD chief, Ray Kelly, from earlier this morning.
These individuals did, in fact, place these bombs, or what they thought to be bombs, in vehicles right in front of the building.
Authorities say the men never got the real weapons they needed to pull off the strikes, and police say the men don't appear to be part of any large international terrorist group. New reports out this morning say that the Treasury Department is ready to give more bailout money to GMAC. The finance company provides loans for GM cars, among other activities, and the latest injection of cash could top $7 billion. And finally, American Idol, one of the most popular shows on TV, wrapped up season 8 last night.
After the nationwide vote of nearly 100 million, the winner of American Idol 2009 is...
That Ryan Seacrest speaks too fast. I can barely understand him. He runs everything together.
Dramatic pause.
Yeah.
Almost 24 million
Maybe you should
people.
Try that, John.
Okay.
That's my job.
All right. Almost 24 million people watch Chris Allen from Arkansas beat California rocker Adam Lambert. And that's a look at your news. Back to you, John and Catherine.
Thank you, fam.
You know what makes me happy? Giving you a hard time in the morning.
Oh, that's nice. I like that, too.
Now, hey, 40 years ago, it would be hard to imagine this scene in presidential politics.
Although we weren't able to shatter that highest, hardest glass ceiling this time, thanks to you, it's got about 18 million cracks in it.
Yeah, sounds like a different version of American Idol. That, of course, is now Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, back when she was conceding the Democratic nomination for President Barack Obama. Now, for many people, that race was a bellwether of just how far women have come in the decades since the 70s. But while we've made inroads into traditionally male enclaves, are we happier? A paper published this week by the National Bureau of Economic Research says no. Think of it as the new gender gap. We go now to the co-authors of that paper, Justin Wolfers and Betsy Stevenson, both professors at the Wharton School of Business at UPenn. Good morning to you both. Now, Professor Wolfers, I want to start with you. Give us a quick snapshot of what this paper was saying.
Sure. We've been looking at large-scale statistical surveys of the American population over the past 35 years, where they just ask people, taking all things considered, how happy would you say you are? You go back 30, 35 years ago, and women were likely to say they were happier than men. Over the ensuing period, despite the dramatic gains in female that women have made in legal, political, economic life, women have become somewhat less happy and men have become somewhat happier. And today, men are, if anything, slightly happier than women.
Professor Stevenson, Betsy Stevenson, can you explain to me how exactly anyone measures happiness? I mean, maybe people just feel freer to be more blunt about the fact that they're facing a lot of stress.
Sure. Well, first of all, I should say it's absolutely the case that what we could be finding is simply that women are being freer and more honest about their feelings, and that explains why they were saying they were so darn happy in the 70s, and as they've become more honest about their feelings, what we're seeing is a decline in happiness. But let me tell you how we measure it. There's a series of questions that are asked that often fall under the rubric of subjective well-being. So questions that either ask, taken all things together, would you say that you are very happy, pretty happy, not too happy, or sometimes more broader and more evaluative, how would you, asking questions about life satisfaction, say on a scale from 1 to 10. And what we've done is, because we've looked at a number of surveys, we've looked at many different ways of asking these questions about happiness, about life satisfaction, we're finding the same thing regardless of the type of question that we use. And these questions have been validated by psychologists as being quite correlated with more objective measures of happiness.
It just strikes me that this is a study that can be easily pulled into any sort of direction.
Although you're saying it does correlate, that over time it does correlate, that the trend seems to be pretty solid regardless of how you ask the question.
But even the way we've been talking about it this morning, women make more gains, they're less happy.
Absolutely. So what you won't be surprised to hear Rush Limbaugh's interpretation of this, right?
Oh, wait. Hang on. Let me see if I can figure that one out. Go ahead, Professor.
I think you probably figured it out. So, you know, Rush Limbaugh says this proves the women's movement was a mistake. Catherine, it sounds like your interpretation is this tells us that there's difficulties in measuring happiness through time, and maybe that's the right way of thinking about it. A different story might be that through time, women have started to compare themselves to someone different. You know, 30 years ago, you'd compare yourself to the bored housewife next door. Today, the woman in the corner office.
Well, the most disturbing thing to me is that anyone claimed they were happy back in the 70s, but that's a whole other story.
Well, I also think I can't help but hear a chorus of all of my women friends going, less happy? Yeah, I'm doing two jobs at once. I'm trying to figure a lot of things out. Why would I be happy? That, and by the way, what's happiness anyway? Maybe they're content, but they're not happy.
Well, I think you've really pointed to something that might be a big factor here, which is that women are trying to excel in many different domains of their life now. One of the things we find is that in the earlier period, in the 70s, overall happiness was more correlated with your marital happiness than it is today. And I think the reason for that is not that marriage matters less, but that other things matter more than they used to. And so, you know, it's very difficult if you're trying, if your life is now about being satisfied in your job, being satisfied with your family, being satisfied with your role in the community, it's more difficult to hit, you know, 100% in all of those domains, and that might lead us to see women telling us that they're less happy.
All right. I have to ask, because I know that in so-called real life, the two of you are a couple. You must have interesting discussions about happiness in the wake of this research.
Very much so. So you mentioned two interpretations of our research. One is that it's a statistical artifact, and the other is that something's happened to make women less happy. You can guess in our own relationship which one of us takes which view as to what it is that's going on.
I would like to hear that.
So I absolutely feel that women's lives are better, and that women will... We've actually looked at surveys where women are asked, would you rather be a woman today or a woman 30 or 40 years ago? And women overwhelmingly say they'd rather be a woman today. I don't think this is based on some false illusion about how good things are. I think women like the choices and options they have today, and I don't think anybody wants to see us moving backwards. And, you know, one thing I point to is that, you know, one thing that might be going on is we haven't actually hit equality. Hillary didn't actually win, and people might be more frustrated today about the losses because we have higher expectations. And so even though, you know, for example, a woman working in a male-dominated field might not face sexual harassment every day the way she might have in the 1970s, being sexually harassed, say, you know, at all might drive tremendous amounts of frustration and anger because we expect to be a world that's free from that.
Right. Another way of thinking about this is, why don't we contrast how Hillary Clinton feels about the world with how Geraldine Ferraro did?
Ooh, that's a good one. Thank you so much, Justin Wolfers and Betsy Stevenson. I know. Both professors at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania.
Well, we'll book them next week. A compelling study that says women who make social gains are less happy. And how does it involve their marriages? Do you buy all of that? Tell us your take at the website, thetakeaway.org. While you're there, you can hear Television Without Pity's Angel Cohen predict the winner of American Idol. She got it spot on. Chris Allen is the new idol, crowned last night with more than 100 million votes. Our Q&A with Beth Kobliner yesterday, author of Get a Financial Life. She answered questions about the congressional bill on credit cards and offered some help that you can use. You can find it all at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Catherine Lanfer.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
How much is that robot? In the window.
You know me. We've been at war.
Whoa.
Since before either of us even existed. You try killing my mother. You will not kill me.
Cute little cleaning robot or frightening machine gun wielding killer robot? Like their celebrity counterparts, robot movie stars find a different reality in real life. Hiring the Terminators? Turns out robots have to be huggable in the real world. We knew that. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. Thursday, May 21st. I'm John Hockenberry, the H1000, joined by Catherine Lamford, the K9000. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning, John.
Coming. You were the K9000. That's the K12.
Yeah, the 2.0. Coming up this hour, more on the foiled terrorism plot we've been discussing all morning. Plus, a new report shows that 1 in 7 Guantanamo prisoners already released return to terrorism. We're also going to look at new credit card regulations soon to become law. All that and more. But first, these headlines.
And in the headlines, law enforcement has broken up a serious plot to attack Jewish targets in New York and shoot down planes from a nearby military base. 4 men under arrest, due in court later today. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg says he's comforted by the swift response from authorities.
To me, I come out of this feeling more confident than ever before, that when there is something, the police department discovers it and stops it.
Investigators say they infiltrated the group early on. They say the men never got the weapons they needed to pull off the strikes. We'll bring you more on this in a conversation coming right up. Fresh economic info just out the last hour. Jobless claims dipped a little bit in the previous work. That's new claims for unemployment. Better than expected. Analysts were betting on a jump.
What to do with high-profile terror suspects is the focus of President Obama's highly anticipated speech next hour. He's going to explain plans for closing the Guantanamo Bay prison camp. A bipartisan group of senators is blocking his path. This week, nearly every member in the Senate voted to cut off money for the closure. Also, the administration is rolling out new plans for at least one Gitmo detainee. The man accused in the 1998 bombings of American embassies in Africa will stand trial in New York. He'll be the first Gitmo prisoner brought to the U.S. and the first to stand trial in a civilian criminal court.
President isn't the only one talking terror today. Former Vice President Dick Cheney will speak at a think tank just minutes after President Obama speaks. He's harshly criticized the current administration's stance on terror and plans to close Guantanamo Bay.
3 American soldiers are dead and many more wounded after a roadside blast in Baghdad. The explosion hit a team on patrol near an outdoor market. The bomb killed several Iraqi civilians as well.
PR personnel at American Airlines are working overtime, it's safe to say today. A jet pilot failed a breathalyzer. A couple of hundred London to Chicago passengers had to wait when the company pulled the pilot. The company found a replacement and the plane was able to take off. The Dow kicks off at 84.22. Futures trading shows Wall Street will open lower this morning. We're asking you about happy robots. There's an invasion of robots in the world. It turns out they're caregiver robots. That's what people really want. Think of a caregiver role for a robot in your life. Come up with an idea at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. What can robots do for you?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Catherine Lamford. At 9 p.m. last night, police swept in and arrested 4 men allegedly involved in a plot to bomb 2 synagogues in New York City after an elaborate sting operation by the NYPD and the FBI. Officials said the men had planted what they thought were bombs, real bombs. They were actually fake bombs, and were looking for the capability to shoot down a military plane in Newburgh, New York. This morning, Mayor Bloomberg and Police Commissioner Ray Kelly were very reassuring to the communities affected here, and they described the plan. Here's Commissioner Ray Kelly.
No one was at risk. This was a very tightly controlled operation.
How tightly controlled? The details are emerging now. The FBI described it as a painstaking investigation that started in June of last year. Here's Assistant Director in Charge of the FBI's New York Division, Joseph Demarest.
They have bags that were set up, they believe to be bombs, carrying about 30 pounds of explosives, what they believe to be explosives. Here we had vehicles staged by us, by the Joint Terrorism Task Force. They would place a satchel or a bag in a vehicle in front of the temple down the block, and then two more bags into a vehicle parked in front of the synagogue here.
The four men will be arraigned in White Plains, New York, in about 4 hours. We're joined now by Bob Ayers, an American intelligence and security expert and former analyst at the Defense Intelligence Agency. Bob, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Let me spin out a couple more details here. Three of these individuals are American citizens, as far as we know. One has a family connection to Afghanistan. All of them met in prison, which is a little alarming, and they're from Newburgh, New York, which is about 60 miles north of New York City. What of any of these details, just to begin, Bob, strikes you?
Well, one thing that we shouldn't attach too much importance to is the fact that they're American citizens. When we're talking about our radical Muslims, they tend to transcend national allegiance, and they owe their allegiance to their religion. We've had the same problem here in London. So we have to be a little careful in suggesting that there are Americans that have gone bad. There are Muslims that are doing what they think is good.
And in this particular case, what they think is good, was it encouraged by federal authorities? Was it observed by federal authorities? What do you make of what we can gather from these prosecutorial and investigative techniques?
Well, the thing that we can rest assured is when they are tried in court, their defense counsel will stand up and try to make a case that they didn't do this on their own. They were entrapped by the FBI. That's going to be a standard defense strategy. However, based on what we see thus far, it would appear that these people were identified early on in their plotting, and the FBI led them along, let them continue to execute their plot until it got right down to the point where they were actually executing the attacks with fake or non-lethal explosives, and then they moved against them. So it looks like the FBI did a very good job on this one.
And led them, I guess, is the concern that I have. How can you say led them and then not say entrapment? And again, I'm agnostic on this. I'm just trying to figure out what's going on.
Led is my word. Perhaps a better word would have been allowed them to continue with the plot. The FBI certainly had some role to play in that they were providing the missiles and the fake explosives to the plotters. The question for the defense counsel and for the prosecution would be, was this provision of lethal weapons something that the plotters themselves were trying to get, or was it something that the FBI or the informant inside the plot suggested that they use?
Right, and presumably in wiretap evidence, that's where they'll find that information, if it exists at all. Jaish-e-Mohammed, it's a name that exists in the complaint, supposedly supplied by the confidential informant. That he claimed he was a member of Jaish-e-Mohammed. First of all, the significance of that name?
Very little significance. The extremist groups, they come and go. They change their name with great regularity. Don't attach too much credibility or importance to that.
I want to go back to something you were saying at the beginning. These weren't Americans, quote-unquote, gone bad. These were Muslims trying to do what they thought was the greater good. Maybe the fact they were American can be significant. I mean, I'm thinking of Oklahoma City. Obviously, it wasn't his faith that was a question there. It was what he believed needed to have to happen in this country.
Well, you have to examine the motivations of the two groups. When you look at Oklahoma City, the motivation there was not religiously inspired. It was a man who had difficulties accepting the federal government, and he struck against the federal government, not for religious movements purposes, but for basically his own political belief structure.
Well, but perhaps this is political and not necessarily Islam.
Well, it doesn't seem to be political to me, given that they were targeting Jewish buildings, and they were targeting military aircraft, and they were doing this as a conspiracy of which all members of the conspiracy were radical Islamists. That certainly suggests that it's a Islamic conspiracy, not a political conspiracy.
Well, Bob Ayers, the judge who will be at the arraignment at 1 p.m. Eastern Time in White Plains, New York, will certainly have a reaction to the notion of a conspiracy as the complaint is heard in open court, and the suspicion would be that these people will remain in custody. Bob Ayers, thanks so much for joining us. Bob Ayers is American intelligence and security expert, former analyst at the Defense Intelligence Agency. He joined us from London. Again, four men in custody. Arraignment will take place at 1 p.m. this afternoon. A terror plot allegedly against two Jewish synagogues in New York City.
Now, also later this morning, we're going to be covering the two speeches that we're going to hear. Both President Obama, Vice President Dick Cheney, going to give major speeches on the closing of military prisons in Guantanamo Bay. Obviously, this foiled terrorist plot that we've been talking about is going to complicate all this news. Another thing that will complicate how it's all received, the soon-to-be-released Pentagon report indicating that 74 of the 534 prisoners already released from Guantanamo have returned to terrorism or militant activity. There's an article outlining this in this morning's New York Times, our partner, by reporter Sue Buemiller. She joins us now with the details. First off, Elizabeth, let's talk about this Pentagon report. Why is the timing of this so important? Why hasn't it been released yet?
On the one hand, a number of people at the Pentagon said to me that they saw no reason not to release it, but they were nervous about it because they felt it would upset the White House and the president's plans. This has been ready since January.
All right. Now, the previous reports on recidivism were criticized as being too vague. I mean, we're talking about one in seven here, according to this report.
Right.
How different do you think this report will be?
This one isn't. I mean, I have seen it. It's also vague. I mean, that's the problem with these reports. They do have, in this one, they have 29 names of people who they say are confirmed or suspected of returning to terrorism or militant activity. But there's only a handful of those who you can actually verify. The other names you can't find anywhere. And the report says, well, they have engaged in terrorist training. They don't tell you where, or they have they have associated with known terrorists. Again,
okay.
The report doesn't tell you who or where.
Speaking of vague, militant activity. What exactly does that mean?
Well, in the past, the Pentagon had the earliest reports in 2007. That included, you know, making films that were against. Making a documentary about some of the detainees' incarceration at the detention center. So they've changed that, but it's a very vague term. So there has been a lot of criticism of these reports. So the Pentagon was sitting on a report that has been attacked in the past. And yet they had it. So they didn't. They were just kind of paralyzed with inaction. They felt if they released it, they would be criticized for undermining Obama. But if they sit on it, then they're criticized for protecting Obama.
Okay. And very quickly, how do you think this report will complicate the national conversation going on right now this morning about Guantanamo?
Well, of course it will. I mean, there certainly are people on this list who. We have already reported in the New York Times and other places who have done legitimately bad things, like bombing attacks. One of them is highly suspected of participating in a deadly bomb attack on the U.S. embassy in Yemen. Another one has become absolutely confirmed. We have written about him in the New York Times. He has become an important Taliban commander in southern Afghanistan,
right,
working against U.S. forces. So, yes, this is going to complicate things. The recidivism rate here, if you believe the Pentagon's numbers, is much lower than what it is for the general prison population in the United States. But obviously, there is, amongst many Americans, there's going to be a lower tolerance for this kind of recidivism.
It's Elizabeth Buemiller. I want to thank you for joining us. She is a reporter for our partners at the New York Times.
All complicating the argument that Barack Obama is going to need to present for why he's closing Guantanamo, if indeed he is, why he's continuing with the military tribunals, and who, if anyone, is going to be tried in civilian courts.
I cannot wait for the counterpunch this morning of those two speeches.
And Vice President Cheney, what is he running for? Why can't the Republicans fight their own battles? Although I guess he is a Republican. He's still around.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Artificial intelligence has gotten too smart.
No. It's malfunctioning. It might not do anything.
But it could decide to blow away anything that moves, couldn't it? Because $11 million worth of robot just hit the road. Number five is alive.
I'm Catherine Lanford with John Hockenberry. Hey, we're asking you about happy robots. What would you want a happy robot to do in your life? How could a happy robot help you out and put you in a happy world? Here's what Rhonda says on our site. Now that I'm cutting back on visits to the salon, I'd give anything for a robot that could blow out my hair and give me manicures and pedicures. You and me both, sister. Tell us your take at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Sit still while I do your hair.
Perhaps the biggest news today actually is quite serious. It'll be in a speech that President Obama is giving today at about 10 after 10 this morning, if all goes according to schedule. It'll be a speech at the National Archives, and which, oddly enough, that speech is going to be followed by a speech from former Vice President Cheney at the American Enterprise Institute just in about an hour and a half from now. Both are going to be addressing security issues within the United States, and particularly Barack Obama will have to explain for the first time the details of what seems to be an ambiguous and flip-flop-ridden policy on dealing with Guantanamo. Jonathan Mahler, friend of our program, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and author of the book The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power, joins us now from his home in New York. Jonathan, President Obama is going to explain his policy of wanting to close Gitmo, but continuing with military tribunals. Still no particular plan for the 240 detainees inside Gitmo that Congress is up in arms over. What can he possibly lay out, and what are you going to be listening for later on this morning?
Well, I mean, I think the big question is how specific he's going to be willing and able to get, because he does have a sort of impossible task before him. He has to somehow assure everyone that he is proceeding ahead with his plans to close Guantanamo, that it will close as promised in January. At the same time, he has to assure people that, well, for instance, that perhaps that suspected terrorists won't be released onto U.S. soil, that there will be no more returnees to the battlefield, which is to say men who are released will no longer be turning up in some way fighting against the United States or coalition forces. And so it's a sort of impossible balance that he's trying to negotiate here, and the question is sort of how specific he's going to be able to get.
So politically, it's untenable to release them where they could return to the battlefield. It's politically untenable to release them to U.S. custody here in the United States. Most nations won't let them in.
Right.
Somehow
he's trying to persuade other countries to take them in, to take in some of these guys who are ready to be released. But at the same time, the United States doesn't want to take them in. So it's a diplomatic challenge. It's a political challenge. It's a national security challenge. It's really just frankly an almost impossible situation for him.
Okay, so, Jonathan, give me an example. What's one specific you'd like to hear this morning?
Well, I mean, I would really like to hear him. I think the biggest question really is there are a few. One is whether or not he is going to try to push to have some detainees brought onto U.S. soil. So that's certainly one issue he has to deal with.
And there is a report this morning that one detainee may be tried in New York in civilian courts.
Yes. Well, then there's that, right? I mean, there's the whole separate issue of whether or not it looks like now he's answered this question. He has suggested that we are going to return to the military commissions, that some detainees will be tried on Guantanamo in these much maligned military commissions. But, you know, there's also the question of whether he is going to try to find a way, try to persuade lawmakers that we need to put some of these guys
into the United States, even if it's in maximum security prisons in the United States. And that is a very, very difficult political fight.
But, Jonathan, I don't know why it's so difficult. I mean, it seems to me that the Supreme Court has signaled very strongly that it would prefer, on constitutional grounds, that this be dealt with in the judiciary system that actually exists now, not one to be invented by various presidents.
Right.
Why can't the president simply say, hey, Supreme Court, tied my hands here, guys?
Yeah, well, clearly he's getting, I would imagine he's getting pressure from inside the administration, from the Pentagon. And they, you know, there is the question of, you know, in terms of the military commissions, are there guys who have been tortured so much that they're untriable, that we don't have any usable evidence that could be used in federal court? And, well, what do you do with those guys?
And FBI Director Robert Mueller was at the House Judiciary Committee yesterday suggesting that maybe putting them in maximum security prisons even wasn't going to work. Listen to this.
In gang activity around the country, using it as an analogy, there are individuals in our prisons today, as I think you and others are familiar, who operate their gangs from within inside the walls of prisons.
Members of the administration are saying that they can still operate terrorist plots from inside prison. Do you buy that?
I don't, no. But I do think that that really is more than anything, I think, a political issue, as we saw with Congress rejecting the president's proposal for the money he needs to close Guantanamo. No one wants these guys in their districts. So that's a political fight for the president that's going to be very difficult to win, and that's just one of the fights that he has to win here.
Well, it's a difficult mix between politics and justice, and 240 detainees at Guantanamo sort of lie in the balance. Jonathan Mueller, thanks so much for helping us out with that.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Mueller, contributing writer for The New York Times Magazine and author of the book The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power. The president will be speaking within the hour. Now, headlines from Femi Oke.
At 28 minutes past the hour, good morning. Four terror suspects head to court today after law enforcement officials thwarted their plot to blow up Jewish targets in New York and shoot down military planes. The police infiltrated the group and had an informant give the suspects fake bombs. Officials say the men wanted to commit jihad. On Capitol Hill, GMAC is set to get another bailout from the Treasury. GMAC is a financial firm that lends money for GM cars. Numerous reports say that the financial firm is getting another $7.5 billion from the Treasury, which would bring the company's federal tab to more than $12 billion. The deal is expected to close today. Jobless claims were down last week. The Labour Department says that 631,000 people applied for unemployment benefits last week. That's a drop, but ongoing claims for those benefits rose to 6.7 million. And finally, the man who had the job of being the voice of Mickey Mouse for more than 30 years has died.
Listen to this. Earn $999.99 for a mindless day's work. Oh, boy, I'm back in business.
That's the falsetto voice of Wayne Allwine. He started being Mickey Mouse back in 1977. He was the third person to take on the job. Some Allwine trivia for you. He married the woman who was the voice of Minnie Mouse. And Wayne Allwine died at the age of 62, the voice of Mickey Mouse.
Oh, thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Lanford in with John Hockenberry this morning. Now, here is some good news, supposedly, that's coming up on credit cards.
These are important reforms to protect consumers and to bring some common sense rationality into our financial system, and the president looks forward to signing it as quickly as possible.
That, of course, is White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs. He's talking about the much-ballyhooed credit card reform bill. It's going to be on the president's desk in time for him to sign it into law by Memorial Day. Now, the bill limits how credit card companies raise rates, but it still doesn't limit how much, which has led some critics to say, maybe this is a toothless bill. Is it really safer now to use a credit card? Maybe that's in the eyes of the credit card beholder. We're going to turn now to Donna Rosato. She is a senior writer at Money Magazine. Hey, Donna, thanks for joining us this morning.
Great to be here.
Now, if you're a consumer, how different is it really going to be out there for credit card users after Memorial Day?
It depends on what kind of credit card user you are. If you're someone who carries a balance, this is going to be better for you. One of the things that this new bill doesn't allow them to do, the credit card companies, is to raise your rate on existing balances. And the only way they can do that is if you're significantly late, if you're more than 60 days late. So if you carry a balance and your rate's jacked up, which is, you know, has been happening a lot lately, you're going to be more protected now.
But Gibbs says rationality in the system. Maybe the rationality in the system is pay as you go. And you actually looked at some people last summer who have adopted a plastic-free pay-as-you-go lifestyle. How miserable were they?
They were actually very happy people.
Really?
They were miserable when they had a lot of debt. And I interviewed dozens of people who are living without plastic. They went credit card free. And it was incredible how much less stress they had, how much more control they felt they had over their lives.
But can we really talk about a plastic-free financial life, monetary life in this day and age? I mean, don't you need something for emergencies?
Well, you bring up a really good point, Catherine. You know, your credit card, if you use it properly, can help you build up a good credit score if you pay it off every month. The trouble is that if you don't pay it off every month and you rack up a lot of bills and you don't pay them, you're going to pay really steep interest. The average interest rate on a credit card is 14%.
Well, here's what I was talking to some friends about yesterday. They were saying that what you do is use a debit card, which, of course, is no interest rate and there's no charge. There may be some fees. But what you do is get a secured loan from a bank at maybe a 9% or an 8% interest rate for like $20,000 or something like that. Pay that on a low payment back, put that in a separate account and use your debit card to withdraw. Then you basically have a credit card for 9% interest and they can't change it.
And that is a great possibility if you can get that loan
right at
a low rate. And that's harder to do today. And so what I talk to folks is, and you're seeing this now, that people want to save more money and spend less on their credit cards. And you can do that. But the simple way to start doing that is to stop using your credit cards.
Well, I was going to say, even if you have the debit card, we still get to the difference of how different is life if you're using cash instead of a little piece of plastic.
It's going to be less convenient because you're going to have to plan your card, your purchases in advance. If you have plastic with you, this is the difference that it makes. If you have a credit card or even a debit card, it makes it really easy. It's very convenient. You whip it out of your wallet and you can pay. You don't have to give it a lot of thought because you've got some money in your bank account or you have the short-term loan with your credit card. When it's cash, you have to plan ahead. If you're buying something that's more than $50, you're going to need that cash in your wallet.
Go to the ATM.
You go to the ATM. You'll have to. What if you want to buy? I have a man who wanted to purchase a refrigerator. He went to the store. He had researched it. It was $850. When he got there, he was paying for cash. And he was able to negotiate and pay only $700.
Really? Because he was doing cash. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you, though, how many times I have gotten the most nasty stares when I pay for something in cash. I'm in a supermarket line, and I give exact change. People are so annoyed that I'm spending the extra time to give exact change.
But that time is really valuable. Spending the extra time is going to make you more aware. There are all these studies about how does plastic influence you to spend more? It literally makes you less aware of how much you're spending. There was a study of grocery shoppers. The researchers sat outside a grocery store and said they interviewed everybody who came out, people who paid with a credit card and people who paid with cash or checks. The people who paid with a credit card had no idea how much they spent. You know what? The people who used a check or credit or cash, they knew exactly how much they spent.
All right. So you're listening to this conversation right now and you're thinking, okay, that's it. I should just go and cancel the credit cards.
Not a good idea.
Okay.
Here's the reason. This is what the point that you made earlier. Can you really live without a credit card? You can live without the debt and the high interest rate, but if you pay your balance off every month, it's going to really help you with your credit score. If you're applying for a loan or a mortgage, you want to keep that credit card, and you might want it as an emergency backup.
Now, let's leave people with that first step. If they really want to get rid of debt, what is the first step they should take?
First step, stop adding to your debt. Stop using your credit cards if that's the problem for you. And then next, figure out where your money is going. It's hard to control your spending if you have no idea where it's going. You can use sites like Mint.com or Quicken.com to get a quick sense of what you're doing. And then the last thing I would suggest, try using the cash.
Okay, thanks a lot, Donna. Donna Rosato, a senior writer at Money Magazine. And now we're going to turn to our own Femi Oke from the newsroom. What's up, Fem?
Hello there. Good morning, everybody. The time is just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. This morning, the president details his plan to close the Guantanamo Bay prison. Yesterday, the Senate blocked the administration from transferring detainees to U.S. facilities. The Obama administration argues the U.S. will have to take some prisoners if it wants other nations to do the same. Meanwhile, officials say that for the first time, a terrorist suspect detained at Guantanamo will be transferred to the U.S. to stand trial in a civilian court. And after plotting to blow up Jewish targets in New York and shoot down a military plane, four terrorist suspects head to court today. Law enforcement officials arrested them last night in a sting. New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg took part in a press conference earlier this morning.
To me, I come out of this feeling more confident than ever before. That when there is something, the police department discovers it and stops it.
The police and FBI infiltrated the terror group and had an informant give the suspects fake bombs. Now, officials say the men wanted to commit jihad, but they didn't appear to be linked to any major terror organizations. In international news, Georgian police say that they have killed the alleged leader of a military mutiny earlier this month. Two others with him are wounded and in hospital. The government says that the trio sparked a short-lived revolt at a military base near the capital, and Georgia's government originally said that the plot aimed to bring down the government. It later actually dialed back on that allegation. And today, a high-profile internal critic is lashing out at the relationship between Russia and Georgia. Former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev says that Russia's current leadership has rolled back democratic reforms. Now, he didn't name names, but said that leaders are consolidating power and stifling voices of dissent. Let's look at some of the big stories making news this morning. Catherine.
All right. Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And Tyler Brott, a quick question for you, buddy. In Missoula, Montana, how long does it take to get from the top to the bottom of Palouse Falls in Washington State?
Well, it takes about 3.5 seconds, just under 3.5 seconds, to fall 186 feet.
3.5 seconds, 186 feet, and now you hold the record, the kayaking record for going over a falls. Tyler, congratulations.
Great, thank you.
You did this at the beginning of May, correct?
That is correct.
Now, explain to me, you're sitting in a kayak, you're sealed in the kayak. How do you stick to that wave of water that goes over the falls? There's wind there, there's spray there, and then, you know, you land wrong side up and you're dead.
Correct. And then there's actually a lot that goes into running a waterfall, especially running a waterfall of that size. And the line on Palouse is just about a boat width wide, so you really have to be on your game, make sure you're in the right spot. And then it does take a lot of subtle finesse and control to be able to control your boat angle upon entry. That's pretty much the technique of running a waterfall, is just being able to make sure that your kayak is completely vertical at the bottom.
You've got to be completely vertical at the bottom?
Correct. You want to be penetrating into the water and decelerating over a longer period of time. That minimizes the impact forces on your body and will definitely help you come out on the other side in one piece.
And you did have one problem, though, right? You busted a paddle, right?
Correct. Yeah.
What a loser.
It's not uncommon to break a paddle off of a waterfall of that size, and even on smaller waterfalls. So I wasn't too surprised that I broke a paddle, but, yep, I'm pretty happy that's the only thing I did break.
Now, you broke the previous record of 127 feet held by a Brazilian kayaker. Have you been angling for this record for a long time?
I actually held the record previously to the 127 feet with 107 feet up in the Northwest Territories on Alexandra Falls. So I wouldn't say that it's necessarily the record that drives me to do this kind of stuff. You certainly don't do this for the record or for money or any of that kind of thing. It's mainly just personal progression and personal accomplishment. It's a huge, you have to accept some pretty big consequences doing something like that, and you definitely don't want to do it for any motivations other than what it means to you personally to run something like that.
Well, you know, we would have loved to show some pictures on our website, but apparently your motivation to, like, sign an exclusive deal to tie up all of your pictures is part of what's going on here, right, Tyler?
Right. We want to be able to let folks check these photos out in the best way, and that's not necessarily our specialty. So we went ahead and had a media agency take care of all of it, and unfortunately, right now they're keeping some of those photos offline, but everybody can check out the video online if they want.
All right, well, that's good. Well, Tyler, you know, it's totally awesome, and is kayaking your only extreme sport at this point?
Kayaking is definitely my focus and pretty much my one of my only extreme sports that I practice at that level.
And your mom is totally on board?
I wouldn't say that my mom's totally on board, but she's come to accept and understand the things that I do, and understand that's part of being me. So she bears with it all, I guess.
Oh, man, I feel so sorry for that woman. Tyler Broad, thanks so much for being a part of the program. Kayaker, explorer, holder of the kayaking record, 186 feet, the Palouse. Thanks, Tyler.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Robotic beings rule the world. The humans are dead. Humans are dead.
I'm Catherine Lanfer.
I'm John Hockenberry. We're still a few humans around here. What the world needs now is a happy robot, right? What can help you out?
This is Anita calling from Detroit, Michigan, and what I'd like a robot to do is drive me. Thank you.
Robot drivers coming right up. Emily writes on our site, how about a robot that can house my gymnast of a baby for the rest of my pregnancy? Oh, and then give birth to him. That's interesting. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. A robot to carry your fetus. That's interesting. Take my take at thetakeaway.org.
It would be a surrogate robot.
Caregiver robots. It's a real thing. We're going to be talking about it in a moment right after Femi Okeh gives us some headlines.
Good morning. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Today, four terror suspects are due in court. Authorities arrested them late last night, and they have been accused of a plot to blow up New York Jewish targets and shoot down military planes. Law enforcement says that they found the plot early on. They stress the men were nowhere near obtaining the weapons they would need to pull the attacks off. Tackling international terrorism will be the topic of the morning in two dueling speeches. President Obama and former Vice President Dick Cheney are both speaking about counter-terror strategy. President Obama will outline his plans to close the Guantanamo Bay prison camp, and he's facing opposition in Congress on this, including opposition from his own party. And that's a look at some stories making headlines this morning. Back to you two.
Thank you, Femi. Terminator Salvation, the fourth installment, with no Arnold Schwarzenegger of the Terminator franchise. No, the third movie didn't kill the franchise off, thankfully. It hits theaters today, and it takes place in the not-so-distant future, the year 2018. It's already an apocalyptic world, just a few years away, where humans are grossly outnumbered by robots. Kind of an aspirational utopian dream there in the Terminator movie.
We are outnumbered by machines. And we have all lost so very much. But this is not the future my mother warned me about.
Well, if Mom was talking about robots in the real world, chances are she wouldn't be warning you. She'd be telling you of a kind of happy world where humans and machines interact in a way that maybe, you know, the Terminator screenwriters would find rather boring. Sherry Turkle joins us now, professor of science, technology, and society at MIT, where she's also the founder and director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and the Self. She's the author of numerous books, among them her latest title, Simulation and Its Discontents. Sherry, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
So it's so interesting. First of all, what is the narrative of robots in the real world? And then I want to talk about how that dovetails with the kind of sci-fi narrative of robots.
Sure. Well, I think there are kind of two tracks, one of which I focus on and one of which I leave to other people. One track is, of course, the industrial robots, the military robots, the wonderful robots that go into caves in a rock and scope out if there's going to be a detonation and send themselves in rather than soldiers. These are robots that do things, I would say, for us. They're instrumental robots.
But let's just be clear, they're mostly remote control devices being controlled by sentient operators. They're not utterly autonomous robots. Go ahead.
I loved your phrase, aspirational. They're robots with aspirations to be autonomous, but they are not, in fact, at the moment. They are semi-autonomous.
Little Pinocchios.
And then, yes, no Pinocchios yet, not at all. But then the robots I study and the robots that I think are really worth turning our attention to because they tell us so much about ourselves are the robots called sociable robots or relational robots. And these are robots, mostly at this point, developed in Japan, that are trying to take jobs as nannies, as robo-nannies, as robo-babysitters, as robo-elder care, as robo-therapists, as robo-receptionists. And these are robots that really are there with only one purpose, not to do something for you, but to do something to you, and that is to form a relationship with you. So that you can confide in it, so that it can be a kind of counselor, so that it can be a buddy. And having robots as part of our social life and designing robots to be part of our social life, I find that a very compelling question. You know, why? What is it going to do to us? What kind of social life is possible with robots?
Well, and in fact, doesn't that cast more of a reflection on how we view relationships than it even does on how we view robots?
Absolutely. I call it robot as Rorschach. Another robot is a Rorschach for how people think about relationships. I mean, for example, you may remember the Aibo dog, the Sony household entertainment robot that looked like a mechanical dog and you could teach it tricks and, you know, stuff like that. And I interviewed one woman about Aibo, and she said, it's better than a real dog. It won't do dangerous things. It won't betray you. And it won't die suddenly and make you very sad.
Betray you?
Well, it's kind of the Pygmalion myth, refigured for our time. One of the interesting things that you write about a lot, Sherry, is that perhaps some of the best science going on the issue of robots involves not so much the robots, but the adaptability of humans to accept machines and to modify their own behavior to deal with machine robots, no matter what their shortcomings are.
Absolutely. I call it reduction and betrayal. I mean, that is to say that if you kind of get into a thing where you consider an Aibo puppy your true companion, I mean, I'm taking kind of a extreme case, you find yourself kind of molding your day, your habits of life, the way you make that robot into your pet, you know, to meet the affordances of the robot. If we really think about a robot, and this is an area that I do a lot of work in, is robots for elder care. You see people in facilities sort of organizing their patterns to accommodate what the robots can do. So I think really a first question is, you know, why do we want to do this? What, one child I interviewed who was talking about a robotic doll that was designed for her grandmother in a nursing home said, don't we have people to do these jobs? It was kind of like out of the mouths of babes, right?
You know, the Terminator myth and the sci-fi narrative of robots is all about the evil robots. Yet the real-world narrative of robots is all about these caregiver, benign robots. It's almost as though the sci-fi robots are all testosterone and the real-world robots are all, you know, something quite different.
That's a very interesting way to put it. I think that the key is that we don't have the technical part of the technical reason is we really have a limited amount of a technology that really can make an autonomous kind of Iron Man Terminator style robot. But what we do have is our psychologies and our vulnerability. And what robot designers have done very cleverly is to design robots that look you in the eye, make a gesture in your direction, track your movement, recognize that it's you, perhaps know your name. These are not hard technical things. And when that happens, it's our psychology, our vulnerability that kicks in, and we're toast. I mean, when that happens, we feel as though there is a sentience there, there is even a caring presence there. So part of the reason that the actual robots on the ground are these empathic are the empathic robots is that they are leveraging off our vulnerability. I almost think of it as kind of Darwinian signals, that if you look at me in the eye and gesture in my direction, a button is pushed, a Darwinian button is pushed, that I feel as though I'm talking to a kindred spirit.
We're not turning the robots on. The robots, by adopting these gestures, are turning us on. That is such a great takeaway.
That is so well put.
Sherry Turkle, professor of science, technology, and society at MIT, where she is the founder and director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self. That's so great. Her latest book is Simulation and Its Discontents. Thanks, Sherry. And now...
You know, John, we're not robots, but we are always on at The Takeaway. If you've missed anything, you can get our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or iTunes.
All morning we've been giving you details about the police investigation into an alleged bomb plot at two synagogues in Riverdale in the Bronx. The New York City mayor gave a press conference with the police commissioner outside one of those synagogues this morning. We got a call in response.
Hi, this is Jonathan Eppner of Riverdale, New York. I'm calling just to let you know about the Riverdale Temple, where local police precinct didn't manage to leave a police presence at all. They told the director of the nursery school that they were waiting for a shift change, and then they would send some police officers back.
Reassurance from officials, but no change in security at the site of the sting operation.
You know, you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We were talking earlier about credit cards, and one listener said, yeah, try not to use plastic. That doesn't work if you're at the dentist. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Robotic beings rule the world.